Good afternoon and welcome to Little Atoms, Resonance 104.4 FM's fortnightly slice of science, politics and free thinking. Little Atoms has an agenda which is pro-science, rationalist, atheist, humanist and for the progressive left. This week we'll be celebrating 120 years of New Humanist magazine with Padraig Reedy and Martin Rosen. We'll listen to a few more minutes of Kev Hopper's theme tune. A few more seconds, actually. I think minutes would be overdoing it. A few more seconds of Kev Hopper's theme music, and then Neil will introduce our guests for some quality enlightenment value FM discussion.
By Padraig Reedy. Padraig is the deputy editor of New Humanist magazine, which has been celebrating its 120th anniversary this year. Padraig's writing has also featured in The Guardian, The Independent and The Irish Post, among others. It's also our pleasure to be joined by Martin Rowson. Martin is a cartoonist, probably best known for his regular cartoon in The Guardian. He also contributes regularly to New Humanist, hence his appearance on the show. Martin has written cartoon editions of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, and is currently chairman of the British Cartoonists Association. Martin was made Cartoonist Laureate of London in 2001 by Mayor Ken Livingstone. So, if I can just say welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the show. Padraig, could you tell us first about the history of the magazine? It's celebrating its 120th anniversary, as I've just said.
Yes, it's difficult to sum up in how long have we got.
A bit less
than 120 years, yes. We were started back in 1885 as Watt's Literary Guide, which was an odd little publication. Because of the strict adherence to blasphemy laws at the time, it was quite dangerous to be openly atheistic. But of course, at the same time, it was a time of great secular movement with people like Bradlaugh, Annie Besant, and so on.
And Darwin.
Well, I think Darwin was nearly dead by then, was he? But yes, though Darwin had, you know, the publication of The Origin of the Species had done a huge amount. So we started as a part of the Rationalist Press Association, which was dedicated to publishing controversial-ish tracts. And the Watt's Literary Guide, which New Humanist started off as, was part polemic and part, really, an attempt to sell these cheap prints that the RPA did.
Mm-hmm.
We evolved then into the, under various guises, there was the Watt's Literary Guide, then there was the Literary Guide and Review, and then it became the Humanist, and then finally in the 60s, the New Humanist, in the 60s when everything had to be new. And currently we, as I said, we're celebrating 120 years with as much to do now, I would imagine, as there was in 1885, sadly.
So would you say that the climate is more difficult now? Not necessarily than in the 1880s, but certainly, say, since New Humanist came into being in the 60s. Do you think now is a particularly tough time to publish in a humanist magazine?
It's a time of of difficulty and opportunity, to paraphrase the old IRA phrase, in the sense that I think we seem to think, which is why magazines like New Humanist slightly died a death in the 70s and 80s. I think a lot of us were under the impression that the 60s came along and we won, and that was it. Everyone's secular and happy, and we all get on now. Of course, how far back you want to trace it has proved horribly, horribly wrong. Mm. If you want to trace back, as Francis Swain did, to 1979, which is an arbitrary starting point, but as good a starting point as any, right through the 80s and Reagan's embrace of the religious right in America, and the increasing Islamization of the Middle East and the broader Muslim world, and right up to today, even in this country, where there seems to be a resurgence, oddly, of some kind of respect and deference to the church, which, honestly, we thought was dead. So despite the fact that things like actual church attendance is declining, we're in an odd position where the church now, churches now, rather, have as much influence as they ever had.
Yeah, it's very interesting that Neil asked that, because I had almost exactly the same question to ask you both, really, which was whether you feel that, maybe I'll ask Martin this one, whether you feel that atheism is in retreat at all. I mean, it seems almost that we've...
Well, I don't think it's in retreat. I mean, it's very interesting, this deference we should give to the leaders of churches, Christian churches, giving them influence out of all proportion to their constituencies. And it was sort of reflected in the way the coverage of the Pope's funeral, which I thought was a sort of fascinating insight into the way the media works. But if you deconstructed it, whereas 400 years ago you would have had footage on BBC News 24 of people dancing around bonfires celebrating with glee the death of the Antichrist, here everybody was talking about this rather reactionary old man who hadn't been allowed to die with dignity being treated as if he was a saint, though I read yesterday that certain leading Catholic theologians are trying to oppose his canonisation. And I worked out what it was. It was the fact that we are now fully secularised. The people who set the news agenda are secularised, the news media is secularised. And it was out of embarrassment. They didn't know how to deal with this. They don't know how to deal with religion. So there's the thought, well, if we actually ignore it, somebody somewhere might be offended. And because we're sort of nice and liberal, we don't want to offend anybody, which I think is a fundamental misreading of the basis of liberalism.
Absolutely.
I think liberalism is actually about sort of regulating hatred, in fact.
I think Polly Toynbee, who I know you've shared a platform with in the past, has said something about my right to offend an idiot, basically. I think it was quite a strong way of putting it.
Well, it's also the idiot's right to be an idiot, but my right to tell the idiot that they are an idiot. But it's... I mean, listening to Cardinal... I can never get his names in the right order. Cormac
Murphy O'Connor.
That's the one, thank you very much. Coming along and... I remember he was... I think it was after the militant Sikhs closed down the play in Birmingham. And arguing that this was an attack on all religion. And these people who have been hating each other and fighting each other with their rival claims to an exclusivity of orthodoxy for thousands of years suddenly seem to have found common cause. So, you know, the next step, the truly horrible step, and in fact, I've got a novel coming out in January, as a quick plug, which is part of it is posited on the idea that in the future there will be a fundamentalist alliance between the Islamists and the Christian right in America, because they actually have far more in common than they have dividing them, but they just haven't yet worked it out, because fortunately they still hate each other more than they hate us. But one day they're going to suss this out.
You could say the same thing about the fundamentalist Israelis and the fundamentalist Muslims in the Middle East, that they have far more in common than they actually think, but they don't ever seem to get their act together and realise that.
But also the Arab world, you know, they all actually hate each other more than they hate the State of Israel. The Israelis all hate each other more than they hate the Arabs. And everybody hates each other, but this is getting back to a correct definition of liberalism, which is it's about regulating hatred, so we can argue with each other, we can despise each other, we can hate each other, often for extremely good reasons, but we don't kill each other.
Yes.
That's the point.
If I could just make an aside, just going back to something you mentioned, we were talking about the death of the Pope, and I wonder if, I think the Pope's a good test case, because he obviously was an incredibly important religious figure, but possibly one of the most sort of important people to die after what we could call perhaps the Diana effect. And I've been incredibly amazed at the sort of coverage that the death of George Best has had recently.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
And I wonder if, like, because the Pope obviously he is religious, but also everybody just wants to display their sort of grief in public.
There's an argument certainly that in our increasingly secularised age, there is still a need for common ritual. I'm dubious about the argument. I think there's a perceived need. There's an imagination that there is a need, which then circles into tons of press coverage, because as Martin said, people are afraid that they might offend someone, therefore mm-hmm. they'll go completely over the top. So I can understand the George Best funeral being shown on BBC Northern Ireland, but being shown throughout the UK was just odd, even though, you know, it's fine. And you know, if you're going to show some mad old woman being buried, and you're going to show some mad old Polish guy being buried, then why not have George Best? Mm-hmm. At least he actually, you know, entertain people a bit more.
Yeah. But of course, though, they're afraid they might offend not everybody, but the fundamentalists, because if they offend me, which they do by the coverage of the Pope's death, if I can be bothered, I might write a letter to the BBC or something. I'm certainly not going to murder anybody.
Well, maybe that's what we need to be doing. I was told today that
that's illegal, Patrick.
Is that incitement?
Yes, that's incitement. Incitement to murder, which is illegal now.
And we have that on tape as well.
That reminds me. I didn't mean to. I emailed the Home Office recently asking if I could sue the Scientologist who had set up outside Angel Tube Station, because their very presence fills me with hatred. And are they actually inciting me to religious hatred? And if so, could I take them to court for it? But, I'm completely gone off the point here.
Well, that's a very enjoyable point.
Yeah.
let's go on to the incitement to religious hatred law. I mean, this is quite an astonishing thing to anybody that positions themselves as a liberal, never mind as as an atheist. So what's the magazine's position on that?
Oh, very much anti. I mean, we were planning, as soon as it goes through law, to bring out a hate issue, which would take part pretty much every religion that exists in the country, maybe do a one-page feature on exactly why to hate it and its followers and everything it stands for, and see what happens. But it sounds so prosaic, and it just bears repeating so much. The fact that I can't hate them, they're telling me that I can't hate someone because of what they believe, just seems ridiculous. And the fact that I can't offend someone whose beliefs profoundly offend me, again, it's just ridiculous. I mean, I believe in social democracy, and I believe in human rights, I believe in them profoundly. And I often hear people being very offensive about such concepts, and do I then have a right somehow to say, well, this is a very deeply held belief of mine, you can't say that? Of course I don't.
Well, apparently not.
I have to defend it. I have to justify my own friends. I can be offended, fine, but I can't take them to court. It's again, it's coming back to the privileging, which religions somehow buy. But because it's this otherworldly thing, then it's untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Of course, the argument that the government would say, and indeed as David Aronovich did on this programme, said, well, we're really rather worrying about nothing. It's just closing a little loophole in which racists have been able to attack, carry on with racist attacks and abusive language, but just by substituting the word Islam instead of...
The fact is, incitement to hatred is already a crime. Assaulting someone, the last time I checked, is already a crime. And so why then... I mean, maybe you can get into racial issues. I mean, and to be honest, if you can't pick apart a BNP pamphlet which is masquerading to be against Islam when clearly it's about paki bashing, then I don't think you're a very worthwhile lawyer. It's a point Nick Cohen made in New Humanist last year, that it just seems nonsensical. It may be in a sense protecting, but it's setting a dangerous.
It seems to be also to me complicating the matter rather than actually making it simple. The simpler thing I would have thought would be to take away the because they're saying, well, it's granting the same rights that
Sikhs and Jews
already have. I mean, perhaps the simpler one,
which takes away the slight complication of Sikhism and Judaism, which tend to be monoethnic religions. But apart from that, I mean, you're quite right, in the sense, if you were to look at, say, the case in Ontario recently, where you had Hasidic courts and Native American courts, and we were that close to getting Sharia courts, and due to a lot of lobbying, which is one of the rare secularist successes, rather than amend slightly, the Canadian government decided not to bring in the Sharia courts, and also to get rid of the Hasidic courts and the Native American courts, because, you know, you either did one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big win, isn't it? I mean, that's something that's come out in this debate about the Sharia courts that I wasn't aware of, that there was already Hasidic courts and things, and that's...
It just seems, you know, it's not... It's the
the full, I mean, people tend to bang on about multiculturalism, but again, there is a point where you're not actually giving people more rights, you're giving people less rights in the eyes of the law, because you're sectioning them off.
Yeah, and certainly, well, with, under Islam, if you're a woman as well, you'd be even
well,
less.
Or any religion, if you're a woman, you're
screwed. Well, fair point.
There were some rather good Neolithic religions which were pretty pro-women.
Yeah.
But they're not around anymore.
Exactly.
Well, there's
men in skirts took care of that. Yes.
There is arguments which I don't know very much about, so I don't know where this is going to go, but that it's only the sort of, you know, the beginning of the sort of Judeo-Christian religions and the sort of worshipping an invisible god rather than worshipping the earth, where the idea of it not being a feminine god, you know, a lot of the, you know, the earth worshipping gods were feminine. It was only when we brought in the idea of worshipping an invisible sky god that it became sort of a patriarchal thing.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm an atheist, is because if you look at the history of the development of religions, and particularly Christianity and Islam, they are founded so obviously in anthropology, sociology, and politics that their development is so clear why they work. You have a nice monotheistic religion. It means you can actually go anywhere you like. You don't have to sort of base your cult on a particular tree in a particular valley. Therefore, it seems so obvious that they are the creation of human societies that I cannot understand how we've got to the position where we are tiptoeing round the sensibilities of people because we might offend their particular variant on the tooth fairy. I mean, it's deranged. It is frankly deranged.
I think Padraig got close to it earlier on when you were mentioning, you know, that people seem to feel that they need some kind of religious experience, even if it's not actually called that, and again, and you quite rightly put through some doubt into that, and it's a concept I hate, the one of the God-shaped hole which some people talk about us having now. You know, we've got this God-shaped hole in our lives. Well, there's no hole in my life. Is there a hole in yours, Martin?
Well, there are several holes in my life, but none of them are shaped like God. Well, there was that interesting piece of scientific research last year, which I actually wrote about in New Humanist, saying that there was a belief gene, that some people are more inclined towards a need for belief. And there are perfectly good evolutionary survival reasons for having religions, because they tell you not to eat the wrong thing, they sort of give you a sense of coherence, and you're trying to work out what's going on in a desert sometime in the late Neolithic. I think we may have grown beyond that kind of thing now, but an awful lot of people haven't. And there's a very obvious reason why they haven't, because it's a marvellous way of controlling other people. It's about control and hegemony and power. And you have this monstrous regiment of ghastly old men, most of them have beards, telling us what to do and telling people what they can't do. And what's it got to do with them? It's got to do with them because they say some mythical being in the sky has ordained it in a book thousands of years ago.
The belief gene, I was going to mention this, because this is actually something I won't say I agree with, but I can see what the attraction is, because I wasn't brought up in a religious household by any means, but, you know, from the earliest age, I have just not been able to understand the slightest why somebody would believe, why would be so, you know, taken up by religion. It absolutely bewilders me, and it makes me sort of think that there is something missing in me, that perhaps, you know, I am just missing that gene, when so many other people in the world are quite happily to be taken in by it. And it's something that's attractive as an explanation, I think.
And it's also very helpful in dealing with death, which is the one thing which we will experience and which we know nothing about.
Sure.
That there are a whole different realm of ways of us coping with the fact we're probably one of the few mammalian species that has a prescience of our own deaths, and I think laughter's a pretty good way of dealing with it, professionally and personally. Crack cocaine's another way, booze, Benelin.
How do you feel when
spectrum with vodka chasers?
How do you feel when you hear? I mean, I can imagine some people will be nodding their heads and listening to this show and going, "Yep, absolutely. You know, it's great to hear you giving religion a good kicking like that. That's why I became a paganist, or that's why I became interested in chaos magic and stuff like that." I've met people who seriously do say that. You know, say I have absolutely no time for religion. I'm a chaos magician, and I mean, I'm kind of opening it out into what New Humanist magazine is about and what we're all about, which is that, you know, we talk about religion in the same way as we do about superstition, and some people find that a bit odd.
Yeah, I mean, you get this. I mean, the Catholic Church tends to be very good on, you know, you shouldn't be into astrology and so on, because that's superstitious.
Yes.
As opposed to Towers of Ivory, Halls of Gold. God, I'm thinking back to my childhood here. Happy days. You know, I mean, there is certainly a compartmentalization where people do this. I'm not into organized religion. You should come to my Wiki group on Wednesday. And there's the element of still, I think, maybe there's still the element, and I think this is the absolute key. Maybe not the absolute key, but certainly important, that Martin alluded to, is death. The idea that, and death, and more broadly, the idea that it's all completely random. This is just absolutely rubbish. The whole thing just came about completely by chance, and it could have turned out a million one different ways. I was watching David Attenborough's spider thing last night. Have you been watching that? It's absolutely fantastic. Have you seen that?
Unfortunately, I missed it almost.
It's brilliant, but utterly awe-inspiring in some sense, and you can understand why suddenly then you might think, I haven't found myself. I think that's all a bit too kind of, you know, how does the spider know how to do that and that? And the idea that it just figured out how to do that over, I think a lot of people can't deal with the scale either, which is the problem anti-evolutionists and talented designers have. They cannot deal with the scale that we're talking hundreds and hundreds and millions of years.
Yeah, and it's completely towards beyond Prince Charles's, wind through a scrapyard making a 747 thing.
Yeah, it's completely beyond my comprehension. I mean, I'm going to live, hopefully, over 50. And
pass
the bell in there. But, you know, the idea of hundreds of millions of years is completely beyond human comprehension. So we try to fill this gap rather than accept the fact that we just don't know. We fill the gaps all the time.
Well, I think this renewed sort of scopes trial nonsense with intelligent design, I think it's wonderful that any group of people could be so desperate to try and claw back some kind of scientific credibility by coming up with something called intelligent design. Well, if you look at the natural world, just look at human beings. You look at the human anatomy. It's obvious that if we had been designed by anything with any intelligence, women would have four back legs, so their pelvises would be much larger, so children could be born at an age when their brains are developed sufficiently large so they didn't have to look after them for the first 10 years of their lives. They could immediately walk away and become accountants. Likewise, men would not have their genitals hanging down. I mean, this is an interesting fact for your listeners. The one thing that human beings or human males have in common with ducks is that they both have a part of their body maintained at a lower temperature than the rest of their body. In the case, it's ducks' feet, because they're paddling around in cold water. In the case of human beings, it's their scrota, because they have to keep it at a lower temperature than the temperature of the body, otherwise the sperm dies.
Now that is not examples of that, is it?
I'm sure there are more
for the purposes
of illustration. But to say that anything intelligent, that's a complete cock-up. I mean, you know, you get
whose idea was this?
It's Richard Dawkins's line that actually it is far more awe-inspiring and wonderful to look at this thing, which is the result of a random series of events, than it is to assume it's the work of some sky god.
Yeah, it's really mundane to think that it's just some guy made. There are so many examples of the natural world where you think if someone was, you know, really going to have the best go they could at it, then they've really made a bad job. And the intelligent designers have just picked up on this. I'm not sure of the actual title, but this movie about the penguins, the March of the Penguins, and I'm saying that, you know, the penguins show family values, and you know, this is a great example of intelligent design. And then I don't know who it was, but somebody wrote, I'm sorry, I can't quote them exactly, but that if God had designed the penguins who do this 120-mile walk from one side of Antarctica to the other or something, he wouldn't have given them little tiny feet and legs.
He would have given them motorbikes.
That's the other concept. It's Christopher Hitchens' point. He finds himself as not an atheist, but an anti-theist, because if there is a God, he's a complete bastard. What has he done to us?
It's that wonderful bit from Evelyn Waugh's diaries, when Evelyn Waugh and his mate Bob Laycock were intelligence officers in the British Army in Yugoslavia during the war, and they were stuck in a field somewhere in Croatia in a tent with Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill's son, who was driving them up the wall, and Tito's partisans wouldn't talk to them because Waugh had been putting out this rumour that Tito was a woman and they didn't like this very much. And they were stuck for weeks in the pouring rain in this tent in this field in Croatia, and Randolph Churchill was driving them up the wall. So Evelyn Waugh and Laycock decided the only way to shut him up was to bet him that he couldn't read the Bible from cover to cover. Because apparently Waugh's nanny used to read, only ever read one book, which was the Bible. She'd finish it and start again at the beginning. And Churchill disappeared off to his tent for 3 days. For 3 days they had perfect peace and calm. And then Churchill burst into their tent one evening, slamming the book shut, the Bible shut, halfway through the second book of Kings, going, "Jesus Christ, God really is a shit, isn't it?" It's in the public domain, Longman's 1978.
Okay, so I think that's probably the perfect time for us to
Oh, yeah.
Get a record.
Just before we do, I just wanted to discuss, it kind of fits in what we're saying. I actually went to see a creationist speak, and he was there. Ostensibly, he wanted to demolish Dawkins' ideas, and he wasn't very good at it. And the one thing that absolutely flummoxed him quite early on was somebody said to him, "Well, what about the rise in backache? There's so many people have backache, and that's, you know, everyone reckons it's because really we should be walking around on all fours, and it's only because we've started standing up and that we have terrible backache." And he really was flummoxed by it and just said, "Well, we just don't look after ourselves."
Well, it's likewise if you look at the fossil record and assume that the fossils weren't put in the rocks to tempt us into the era of Darwinism. If you think about how many species have existed, it must have been terribly, terribly crowded.
Oh, sorry, Neil. Do you want to play your record?
Yeah, should we play a record, Jamie? If that's okay. Well, this is Neutral Milk Hotel, and the track is "In the Aeroplane Over the Sea."
What a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. What a beautiful dream that could flash on the screen in a blink of an eye and be gone from me. Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me. And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea. But for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see. Love to be in the arms of all I'm keeping here. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM. That was Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Aeroplane Over the Sea.
And Neil and I are sitting here in the company of Martin Rosen and Padraig Reedy. And we're talking about the New Humanist magazine, which is now celebrating 120 years. What I wanted to ask you is, it's something that I keeps being asked to me all the time, or people keep pointing this out to me and saying, well, you know, it's all very well being an atheist, but really, you know, it's just another faith position. And really, you should be an agnostic, because you just don't know. And I always say, well, no, I am an atheist. I'm not happy with being called an agnostic. How do you feel when somebody gives you that argument, if indeed they have?
Well, I mean, if they say it's a faith position, so what? The whole part, I mean, this is one of the new great lies by so-called faith communities, that they're all in it together, whereas in fact they're not, because they all claim an exclusive right to the truth, and they can't all be in it together. Mm-hmm. They must be right or wrong. I mean, you can't say that, you know, actually, if you had the Aztec high priest arguing it out with, I don't know, some Olympian, priest of the Olympian god, saying, well, actually, you know, we're all in it together, it's all sort of one god. That is the step, that is their step towards agnosticism. I'm not an agnostic, I'm an atheist, not least of all because, actually, to quote Bakunin, standing Voltaire on his head, if God existed, it would be necessary to destroy him. And I just find it objectionable and, as Padraig has said earlier on, you know, deeply offensive, this sort of denying our humanity, claiming there's some higher authority which has created us and is guiding our lives and is then going to look after us after we're dead. It's denying the wonderful majesty of human life and of human experience and of human culture and everything else and the good sides and the bad sides. And it's a cop-out. It is a feeble cop-out. And were gods to walk in, would presumably walk through the door, through, you know, like through a wall, and say, actually, you're wrong, and say, well...
descending.
Yeah, well, or coming up from the ground, we don't know. He might be this table, I don't know, and say, actually, it's all true. I'd say, well, fine, but I don't want any part of it. Thank you very much.
Good answer.
I don't know if you can really add to that.
Can I just ask then, if I want to bring us on to your work as a cartoonist, Martin. Does humanism inform your work in general, would you say?
Well, it's a bit like the old argument which certainly people in the National Secular Society have been agitating for years to get a slot on Thought for the Day. I always thought this was a rather futile campaign, as you can imagine somebody saying. So I was walking down the street the other day, I saw a Boy Scout helping an old lady across the road, and this just reminded me how much I don't believe in God. I like to think... Actually, I just like to think, let's put it like that. But also the fact that I believe that in order to be a responsible member of a democratic society, you should be allowed to express your thoughts and express what you think. And you should also be allowed to hold the power elites to account. Mm-hmm. And there are various ways of doing that. Voting is one way. Mercilessly mocking them is another way. And, of course, the remarkable thing about religions is they are always scrambling to be part of that power elite. Mm-hmm. So I'd lump them in with the rest of them.
Well, you wrote quite interestingly in the Guardian recently about your shock at the sort of vitriol that you get from, particularly from Americans, for your position.
It wasn't shock at the vitriol. It was sort of mild surprise that they should be so upset. Mm-hmm. I can't possibly quote some of the things they said, because really quite strong stuff. And there was one particularly wonderful one, which went on for pages and pages and pages. I wanted to paste it into a general reply to all the rest, saying, I think this person has made your point so much more than you have. But unfortunately, I'm too much of a Luddite to be able to do that. It's because they cannot, and this I think fits in with religion, fits in with the attitude of people who want a law banning incitement to religious hatred, that they are so insecure, the citizens of this country, which has actually been ruling the world for the last 60 years, that they cannot even bear the idea of somebody doing a stupid drawing about their president. They can brook no criticism. And that sort of suggests a great deal of insecurity. I mean, I've often said to members of faith communities who say, what you've just said is terribly offensive. And I say, for Christ's sake, the person you presume to believe in is the most powerful being in creation, to the point where he actually created creation.
He can take it.
And he can take it. What's your problem? What's your problem? And it just... I just can never get over this. You know, you cannot say this is offensive to my religion. Well... who cares?
I imagine if he couldn't take it, he would probably smite you down in some way.
Well, it sort of suggests that he probably doesn't exist, the fact that he doesn't.
Or that he's just not that bothered.
Well, he's sort of, yes, or he's just incompetent, buggered off years ago.
So is it the religious community who are most annoyed by your cartoons, or is it... Or do you find that the...
I mean...
all of your targets end up saying, well, yes, it's a little unfair.
It's actually... I mean, it gets back to what we were talking about at the top of the programme, about the definition of liberalism. And, I mean, I personally think that the kind of liberalism we have in this country is one of the most beautiful gifts this country has given to the world. And it comes out of the glorious revolution of 1688, when concluded, you know, if you 30 years previously you'd had a series of civil wars where a tenth of the population of this country was killed in basically what were arguments over the liturgy. And just say, you've got to stop. You've got to stop. And so you sublimate that into a free press and into free expression and into satire. So you have this marvellous blossoming of satire in the 18th century with Swift, Pope, then Hogarth and Gilray. And I've often said that, you know, the point about political cartoons, because they're caught up with voodoo, this very primitive kind of magic, it's actually taking somebody's appearance and shape-shifting it and recreating them through the hand and eye of the cartoonist and then setting up in a narrative of the cartoonist's own creation in order to mock them, to make them look ridiculous. And this is essentially assassination by any other means, without the blood, which is a good thing.
Well, this is one of the things interesting about the criticism of you, because, you know, I really enjoyed the cartoon in The Guardian yesterday. You had David Cameron in a sort of little Lord Fauntleroy get-up.
Did you notice the little sort of spoon sticking out of his nose?
I must admit, I thought that was
that's
a snotty nose at first. It's only on closer inspection I realised it was a tiny little spoon.
Possibly libelous, so.
Out of his nose, yeah. You're going to end up getting thrown out of the studio in a Dennis Skinner-esque comment. But, yeah, you know, there's Cameron as little Lord Fauntleroy and obviously Michael Howard as Dracula. And these are, you know, obviously... absolutely right on the money, but they're inevitably quite crude stereotypes, and that's obviously the sort of the language you're trading in the form of the cartoon. So it does surprise me that people don't really get that and can be so upset.
Well,
by it.
I mean, I do get from America the occasional thoughtful, or mildly thoughtful, email saying that these crude images have no subtlety and no sense of balance and things like that, and they're quite right. They don't. That's the nature of the medium. Mm-hmm. Somebody once described political cartooning as corrective surgery performed with a cudgel, which I think is quite a good way of describing it, because it's not about having a balanced argument. It is about summarising a political event and then putting a spin on it, which is the cartoonist's own political point of view, and it could be like right wing or left wing, but It is about voodoo. It's about giving offence. It's about being rude. Because it's, and essentially it's not in order to make things better, it's just to even out the balance between the powerful and the leaders and the powerless who are the led. Because there is an unequal equation. These people could have me killed if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And all I do is stupid drawings of them to make people feel better.
I mean, you describe the stupid drawings, but do you think you are actually quite powerful? Do you think you've, for example, do you think you've managed to change anybody's opinion of somebody?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think the underlying motivation is to make people sceptical about their political leaders, so they question them by making them look ridiculous, and I think that's a central part of the secular liberal society I'd rather hope we lived in. I mean, take, for example, my friend and colleague Steve Bell's depiction of John Major wearing his underpants on the outside, which is an iconic image. But I don't think it changed people's attitude to the Major government. I think it reconfirmed the general and growing awareness that this man was a hopeless nerd. Because Steve and I have been doing cartoons knocking Blair ever since he was elected leader. And it was only after about 2000, when the Teflon started cracking off Blair, that, you know, people enjoyed them, they thought they were funny, and then they actually thought they were beginning to make a point, because, you know, that's the way the media works.
We're at the moment, we're in a time when there are less and less people becoming involved in politics, less and less people voting, and people saying, well, this is, you know, people are very cynical about politicians. Do you think your work is increasing that cynicism, and if so, is it something we should be worried about?
No, I don't think my work is increasing cynicism. I'm not a cynic, I'm a sceptic, and I think people should always be sceptical. These people have immense power. We were taken into a war most of the people in this country didn't want, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed in our name, and you should be sceptical about that kind of thing. The reason why people don't vote, well, they don't vote because actually New Labour, apart from the Iraqi war, has actually been a pretty good government, a pretty successful government. And they knew the Tories weren't going to win. It's very interesting. If you do the number crunching, the cephalological number crunching after the 97 election, the turnout in Labour-Tory marginals was massively up. The turnout in safe Labour seats was down. I mean, considerably down, and it stayed down because, you know, Labour supporters don't like New Labour. But it's not to do with cynicism, it's to do with general comfort, the economy's working, things are pretty okay. People who are particularly exercised about politics went out and voted Lib Dem because they wanted to deliver a message to the government, which was actually a very articulate message they delivered to the government.
Would you ever do a cartoon that was designed to encourage people to vote? I'm
yes.
not quite sure how you would do that. It's like quite a tricky remit.
Yes, I certainly would. Yeah. I think they should, but I also don't see why people should vote if they don't want to. It's this idea that...
democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, you're entitled not to turn up.
Exactly.
I mean, there was getting back to Iraq slightly, I loved the coverage after the referendum, which covered, oh, there's so many people voted no, and obviously democracy has failed. And it's like, no, they voted. That's the democratic part. They didn't have to pass the referendum for it to be a success. Voting yes does not equal democracy. But, there's every right people have. And I think maybe you do need something like the Australian model where you can turn up and say none of the above, which is as much of a protest as anything. It's even more vocal protest than not turning up.
Regularly trotted out on radio phone-in shows, you know, that, oh, I'm not voting until they have a none of the above thing. Well, I've never really bought that because I suspect these people still wouldn't bother voting unless they actually had to go in.
Well, I don't know.
I think it's what gets me. I think is that they want to complain about it, but they can't actually be bothered to go and do anything about it.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful story about what happened in Australia when they brought in compulsory voting. That in Melbourne, there's a very large population of Yugoslavs and Greeks who were the parents of immigrants, and they brought their parents over who don't really speak much English, but they were compelled to vote. And in certain wards in Melbourne, these aged Greeks and Yugoslavs are going along to vote, and of course they voted for the first person on the ballot paper. So Mr. let's say Aronovich kept on winning, and now they have to juggle up the names randomly at vast public expense so democracy can be seen to work.
Can we, if we can go back to the, I wanted to talk about the magazine again, but, probably a question you've been asked many times, so apologies if it's boring, but, what's the distinction between humanism and atheism?
Atheism is not, it's not a genuine philosophical standpoint in the sense that humanism is. Atheism means... I do not believe in God. Humanism obviously comes from that. I do not believe in God or any supernatural agents. But I also it's more of a moral sense where I can, without having a strict Ten Commandments, there is an idea that there is some kind of ethical code that we can find without recourse to the supernatural. Sure. Atheism doesn't engage that particular point. It merely... puts your standpoint on strictly the supernatural issue. Humanism has slightly more of an involvement in the world of ethics, morals, and living the good life. So
and that we believe that human beings obviously have the, you know, the ability to form...
Yeah, to figure it out for ourselves.
Exactly.
System,
yeah,
certainly.
That's
the fundamental difference. I mean, I think there is, you know, within this great movement of ours, there is, you know... particular arguments of whether you're a humanist or an atheist or a secularist or a rationalist, And generally, you will find most people who describe themselves in any of the above categories are actually of the exact same mind.
Sure.
I mean, I think some people do find the term humanist a little, almost lily-livered at some points, which it can be. It can seem a little. at times, it can seem maybe a little soft word compared to the. Compared to the compulsion of atheism or rationalism as a hardline stance.
Well, I like the term humanism very much because it's, you know, it's obviously referring to human beings. The term I have to admit finding some embarrassment with is the term bright.
Which seems
very
really bloody patronising, isn't it? Apologies to the London Brights group who first meeting I did attend and subsequently didn't turn up. I think they actually do get people turning up now, but it is. There is that hope, because people do. The marvelous irony where people always say, I find atheists a little smug. And you kind of think, well, hang on, you're the one who thinks I'm going to hell for eternity. And you think I'm smug. But yeah, and Bright really is that smug. I don't believe in God because I'm quite clever.
Yeah.
I should have to explain
for some of our listeners. Really? This was something that turned up about, what was it, 2.5 years ago, I think, wasn't it? And Richard Dawkins was very fond of it, and it was that atheists, instead of, basically atheism was a kind of negative sounding word, and so in rather. They decided to come up with their own word for what they were, which was bright, and this was apparently not to imply that they were more intelligent. But
it does, doesn't
but
it?
It's unavoidable. We use the term bright to mean clever, so I think it was.
Dawkins, I mean, does seem to have backed down from it a bit because it didn't take off in quite the way he'd imagined, I suppose, so he just ditched it. And I can remember him saying at the South Base Ethical Society. Anniversary, was it last year? That he's a little.
He
backed away from it, and there was a little murmuring because all the London Brights were up the front row going, woo.
Well, they were bright, they got the best seats.
They did, they turned up early. Clever people. the only thing I have against Brights, and again, apologies to anybody listening, but they do meet in the non-smoking section of a Pitcher and Piano in Holborn, which just seems like a joylessness personified. Again, apologies to the bright side there.
Well, is it an American thing? Because it does.
It
does
did come
that
from
sort
California.
It did come from California.
Yes, and they actually had their founding mother was in the country recently, I think. It does have that little American. Again, random, sweeping generalisation, but Americans seem a lot more comfortable with the idea of I'm cleverer than you. I mean, I went to see Martin speaking the other week at the LRB, and at one point in the questions afterwards, an American put up his hand and said, well, I understand what you're saying, but others probably wouldn't. You horribly arrogant little man. yes, so I think it is from California. It's from San Diego, I think.
Yeah, I think they'll all probably be quite happy if the term brights quietly disappears and just go back to calling ourselves atheists and humanists again.
I like heretic.
Infidels.
Infidels and heretics. Yeah.
Heathens, probably, possibly.
Yeah, I'm certainly happy to call myself an infidel. I'm with that. So we talked before about, you know, that it's being a particularly difficult time to be a humanist in the world.
At the same time, a time of remarkable. I mean, certainly for the magazine, it's a time of opportunity because, as I said earlier, we used to have to define ourselves. We could just, because we presumed, you know, we're whole world secular, and suddenly we do have to define ourselves, which means that we find an awful lot of people becoming increasingly militant about, yes, I am an atheist and I don't believe any of this. So, in some ways,
I mean, are you finding, for example, that you could now sell the magazine? Because I think people are starting to get annoyed about the fact that Sainsbury's, for example, are no longer going to stock Jerry Springer in the Opera.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people going to be annoyed about that.
No, they
quite
are,
rightly,
yes.
And
yes.
They're the people that should be we should be reaching out to.
Absolutely. I mean, there is. I mean, there isn't. Yeah, well, thankfully, there is. I don't know who I'm thanking, by the way. there's an upswing in... There is a consistent upswing in subscriptions, and you do get letters from people saying, we need this. This is very important, that people have something
in their hands, because let's face it, there's hundreds of, particularly Americans, hundreds of websites about everything, but there's tons of atheist websites and so on, but to have something actually that you can hold in your hand and you can put on your table and that identifies you as... Yeah. As something.
You can be seen reading it on the tube.
Yeah, you can leave it on the tube. And
because, you know, it seems a long way off now, but when socialism was almost, you know, naturally associated with atheism.
It was, back before before the wonderful days of the Honourable Member for Baghdad and Damascus. There were people, a lot of people... Post well, in the initial setup. I mean, it's not, of course, it's not just respect, even though respect is an obvious one. I mean, you look at the Labour Party is dominated by the Christian Socialist Movement in a rather sordid manner. You don't get anywhere in the Labour Party these days unless you are a Christian and seen to be a Christian.
Is that true?
To an extent, yes. In Jack Straw, Blair, obviously, Gordon Brown, Ruth Kelly.
It's interesting that Alistair Campbell, a much maligned figure who I actually quite like because I think he was very good at his job. It wasn't necessarily a very nice job, but he was good at it. but he was a militant atheist, as indeed is his partner Fiona Miller. And just before the Iraq adventure, I was on a committee helping to organise Michael Foot's 90th birthday with Fiona Miller. We were sitting up in the Gay Hussar, in fact. And I turned to her while the other members of the committee were talking about who was on the back bench at the Daily Sketch in 1958, because they were old hacks. And I said, what the hell is going on? Why is your Prime Minister, you know, going to destroy the Labour Party, destroy the United Nations, destroy himself? And she looked at me with some despair in her eyes and said, he thinks he's right. And you could tell that both she and probably Alistair thought... He's a mad Christian. He's been led by God. He thinks, you know, he's actually got that conviction, which you have. Right. I mean, anybody who says he is going to be answerable to God for the deaths he's responsible for is truly terrifying. But by the same token, he recognises... I mean, we're talking about how secularism is under attack. It was very interesting during the last election that Blair, I mean, lied again on TV when he told Jeremy Paxman that he hadn't prayed with George Bush. And this is because he knows that if he admitted to it, he would be... open to massive public ridicule.
Mm-hmm. At least in this country.
In this country, because in America,
his cachet would probably rise even more than it already
is. But in this country, the wonderful process started off in 1688. You know, religion isn't important enough for you to kill each other over it. Therefore, it becomes less and less important. And to come full circle, I think the reason why we're paying any attention to these poor, misguided fantasists is because we have a secularist, liberal mindset, and we're nice and polite people, and we are embarrassed by them, and we don't know how to respond. And they are exploiting that by making an extremely loud noise to say we have to treat them properly. And our embarrassment means we said, yes, okay, that's fine, you go and do whatever you like.
I think this is, you know, people don't really appreciate the difference between the UK and America on this, in that if you're an American politician who... even when anywhere near an atheist position, your career would be over, it would be finished, whereas, you're right, the opposite is... Well, the opposite is not true. Obviously, as you said, they are Christians, but they just are not allowed to bang on about it in the same way.
But in America, you know, you saw those maps after the 2004 election, produced by clever Democrats, with the...
Godland.
Yes, Jesus Stan in the middle, which was the Midwest.
Well, I think we're probably going to have to wrap up.
How long have we got? Yeah, I just wanted to quickly ask you, Martin, just about your novel. Is it a graphic novel?
I've done proper old-fashioned words and paragraphs. It has got pictures in, but they're drawn in the style of Walter Crane, just to confuse people. No, I've done a couple of graphic novels, and they take a bloody eternity. So this is ideas put down in words which didn't quite find elbow room in a cartoon.
Well, that obviously, we were talking before about, you know, cartoon being quite a crude medium, and obviously this is a way that you can expand on things. Okay, well, we're running out of time. So we've had a fantastic offer from Pardraig, which is a first for Little Atoms. Any listeners who would like a subscription to New Humanist magazine, they can get a third off if they call and quote Little Atoms. That means say Little Atoms rather than actually... say shithead or any of the many good quotes that we've had on the show. You can call 0207 436 1151 or email info@newhumanist.org.uk. I'll just say that again. 0207-436-1151 or info@newhumanist.org.uk. And the website is also www.newhumanist.org.uk.
And the magazine's available in Borders and all good bookshops.
Is it?
And some dodgy ones, obviously.
With a cartoon by Martin Rosen on the front in his inimitable style. Thanks very much, gentlemen, for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Can I just give our website out again, which is www.littleatoms.com, where you can download some previous interviews that we've done, and this one eventually, when we pull our finger out. And if I could just thank Jamie Paul for engineering splendidly again.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with a conversation with Ben Goldacre, who does the Bad Science column. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.